Therefore, all things whatsoever ye would that men should do to you, do ye even so to them, for this is the law and the prophets. Matthew 7, verse 12. Here the Lord reveals the Father as the ready and bountiful giver whose storehouse of mercy cannot be exhausted. There is no limit put upon our asking except the limit of our little faith, though he does guard the door of grace with the sole condition that the gift requested be good. But otherwise, what a door of infinite possibilities is opened unto us. What a royal invitation to enter in and enjoy the riches of the Father's house. The connection of the above, Matthew 7, verses 7 through 11, with the following practical admonition, Matthew 7, 12, is easily seen. If we realize the bounty of God of which he has been speaking, we will practice the same lavish giving toward others. We will not only give to them as they have given to us, but the measure of our conduct will be according to God's grace to us. Our heart is enlarged toward all men, even as Paul, who exclaimed, "Ye are not straitened in us, or there is no narrowness in our love to you, but ye are narrow in your own feelings." 2 Corinthians 6, 11 through 12. Our character will be formed by constantly beholding and living in the enjoyment of the riches of God's grace. Therefore, the practical conduct in harmony therewith will follow. He further adds, "This is the law and the prophets," Matthew 7, verse 12b. He is saying by this last phrase that the dispensation of grace, which he is now introducing, is in harmony with all that preceded. God is the same, and his ways, as his principles, are unchanged. He is always aiming at the same results, and while the means may vary with each step of progress, yet the end is that with which he is concerned. The righteousness which the law demanded from man, grace bestows upon him, and God is satisfied. The way of salvation. Enter ye in at the strait gate, for wide is the gate, and broad is the way that leadeth to destruction, and many there be which go in thereat. Because strait is the gate, and narrow is the way which leadeth unto life, and few there be that find it. Matthew 7, verses 13 through 14. He solemnly exhorts them to enter into life through the strait gate. Some have found this very difficult of interpretation, but it simply further emphasizes what he has been teaching, the grace way. It is the strait gate. No halfway keeping of the law will go in thereat. The gate calls for righteousness, therefore it is straight. The way calls for absolute holiness, therefore it is narrow. But grace enables for all the requirements. The further information regarding the wide or broad gate, which leads to destruction, teaches that the multitude of ways of self-effort or law are in contrast to the one way of grace. He informs us that there are but two religions or ways of salvation in the world, regardless of the multitude of sects and divisions. The one is the way of law, the other is the way of grace. The one is to do, the other is to take. We would suppose all men would choose the way of grace in preference to the way of law, but alas, the opposite is the case, as we learn here. The way of self-effort leads to destruction. It is a broad way. It includes the Jew as well as the Catholic, the Mormon, the Russellite, the Seventh-day Adventist, the Mohammedan, etc. The mass of humanity are treading this broad road. It appeals to the reason, the logic of the natural man. It is the way which Proverbs tells us seemeth right unto a man, but the end thereof are the ways of death. Proverbs 14:12. It is a religious way, as a little consideration will show, for no one expects, no matter however careless he may be, the way of vice to lead to heaven. But the real question is of finding the way of life. It appears to be hidden, and so it is from the wise and prudent, but not shut. They only mistake the way of destruction for the way of life, for few there be that find it. The many miss the way not because the terms are hard, but because they themselves are, as they think, good, moral, and upright, and do not need the grace of God, which has provided the way of life, which is Christ himself. For they, being ignorant of God's righteousness, and going about to establish their own righteousness, have not submitted themselves unto the righteousness of God. For Christ is the end of the law for righteousness to everyone that believeth. Romans 10, verses 3 and 4. The gate of life is straight because there is one absolute condition. Self-righteousness must come down. We must come through as a penitent, a suppliant, depending upon the merits of another, for Christ is the only and all-sufficient Savior. Yet the crowds will not come to him that they may have life, John 10:10, and grace can make no other terms with man, for he has been proved by the law and found wanting. The warning which follows regarding the false prophets plainly connects with the foregoing and is certainly suggestive and timely for today when these ravening wolves are abounding. And the special danger regarding them is that they are dressed in sheep's clothing, that is, their outward appearance and conduct are irreproachable. They look like sheep and act like sheep, but they have the wolf nature, cruel, carnal, bloodthirsty. Notice that they are called false prophets. Therefore, they are religious men, preachers, teachers, ministers of righteousness, apparently, Satan's emissary sent out to defeat the purposes of God. He is too cunning and devilish to send out vicious, irreligious men to commend his doctrines and lead the people astray. Why, he himself is transformed into an angel of light. Therefore, it is no marvel that his ministers also are transformed as the ministers of righteousness. 2 Corinthians 11, verses 14 and 15. But we are expected to discern these evil workers and not be caught in their net of lies. Their fruit is the sign of their nature, whether sheep or wolf. Ye shall know them by their fruits. Do men gather grapes of thorns or figs of thistles? Matthew 7:16. They soon prove the source of their life. Are they feeding and caring for the sheep, or are they living off the sheep, fleecing instead of feeding them? Have they got the life, the fruit of the life that lives for others? We are therefore responsible to observe them. Figs and grapes are for food. They are not gathered off a thistle or thorn bush, type of the old creation, which is barren and unfruitful, but grow on the fig tree and grapevine, type of the new creation, which brings forth food for God and man. The old Adam is the corrupt tree that cannot bring forth good fruit, while Christ is the good tree that cannot bring forth bad fruit. The one tree is the opposite of the other. They are to be distinguished absolutely. The one tree, Adam, was hewn down because it was not only useless, but positively injurious. John the Baptist, type of the covenant of law, tells us the same truth. And now also the axe is laid at the root of the trees. Therefore every tree which bringeth not forth good fruit is hewn down and cast into the fire. Matthew 3, verse 10. The law is the axe which cut down the old man. He was found guilty and condemned to die. But Christ stepped into his shoes and was cut down upon the cross. Therefore the bad tree, Adam, died in this substitute. The good tree, Christ, arose out of the ruins of the old and will never be hewn down. His fruit is perfect and cannot be marred or defiled. Wherefore, by their fruits ye shall know them. Then he continues and emphasizes his warning from this same subject, teaching its importance, which we in the end of the age realize. For there is indeed reason today that we have our senses exercised to discern and therefore become able to judge between the false and the true. the evil and the good, the truth and the error. For the barren professor and his works abound on every hand. Not everyone that saith unto me, Lord, Lord, shall enter into the kingdom of heaven, but he that doeth the will of my Father which is in heaven. Matthew 7:21. Men who are still of the old creation call Jesus Lord, but not in spirit or truth. For Paul assures us that no one can call Jesus Lord but by the Holy Ghost, 1 Corinthians 12:3. And this necessitates a new birth whereby we are enabled to do the will of our Heavenly Father. Many people say prayers and call Jesus Lord with their lips while their heart is still in rebellion against God and therefore not in harmony with His will. Many today are apparently serving Him in this condition, but in that coming day of manifestation, empty profession will not suffice. Even prophesying, the casting out of demons, performing miracles, are not the evidence of the new creation, for some of the preachers of Reformation may perform these apparent great works. Men may quit drinking, stealing, and other wicked practices at their solicitation, rebuke, or coercion. They may clean up their backtracks, quit their meanness, and afterwards live a good moral life as the world judges. But Jesus called such whited sepulchres, for their changed habits are not the result of a changed nature. Therefore, good works are not a decisive proof of true discipleship, for true discipleship necessitates heart subjection. Otherwise, the works will be lawlessness or will worship, as Paul terms them, Colossians 2:23. A yielded life which says yes to all the will of God is the sure sign of a true disciple of Jesus. Such Christians are real yes men. Who is wise? Matthew 7:24-27. The true preacher of righteousness now ends his great sermon with two contrasted illustrations. The one exhibits the dependent spirit who finds a stable, steadfast anchorage. Wherefore, whosoever heareth these sayings of mine and doeth them, I will liken him unto a wise man who built his house upon a rock, Matthew 7:24. While the other one depicts the independent soul who believes himself sufficient. And every one that heareth these sayings of mine and doeth them not shall be likened unto a foolish man which built his house upon the sand, Matthew 7:26. He pictures them both as the builder of a house, that which stands for his affections and rest, yea, more, as viewed here, the place of shelter from the deluge, a refuge from the storm. It is the foundation which he emphasizes, for this is of paramount importance in building. Get this firm and stable, and the rest is easy. If the foundation is weak and tottering, no matter how solidly the house is built, it will all fall with the foundation. Christ himself is the rock that abides the tempest shock, all else whatever its nature, however otherwise substantial or suitable, is but sand. He who builds upon the Christ of the Scriptures, the one who died, was buried, and rose again, the head of a new creation, his house will endure the storm. No other foundation can any man lay that will stand the judgment, for the old Adam building has already been condemned and pronounced a ruin. Though while the weather is fair, the building on the sand may appear better, bigger, and more attractive than the house on the rock, but the man who trusts and leans upon it, while he may enjoy a passing triumph, may even mock and sneer at the other building. Yet when the storm has passed, there will be but one remaining, and it will be too late then for some to remedy their foolishness, which the world called wisdom, for they will fall with their house. Let us rejoice indeed if we are on the rock Christ Jesus, building upon him alone. Thus the two heads of the human race are presented here side by side at the close of this matchless Sermon on the Mount. All the truth which it contains is based upon, so to speak, and springs from these two representative men, Adam and Christ. The one has fallen, the other abides. The multitudes were astonished at the doctrine, even as they are today when these deep things are unfolded. They found his manner and words of authority such a contrast to that of the scribes with their unreality, externalism, and form that they were amazed. It was the voice of authority which carried conviction, the voice of the one greater than Moses, who had now appeared not only to take Moses' seat, but to take his own seat, which was indeed higher than that of the lawgiver of the Old Covenant. The sermon falls easily, even as the book of Matthew, into five principal divisions, agreeing with the five books of Moses. We have the Genesis in the first part of Matthew 5, the blessings upon the heirs of promise. That's Matthew 5, verses 1 through 7. While the Exodus comes in the latter half of Matthew 5, the separation of the heirs from the world, Matthew 5, 18 through 48. Then the Leviticus section begins with Matthew 6, the sanctuary part, 6 verses 1 through 18. The Numbers section continues in Matthew 6, the wilderness experience, Matthew 6, verses 19 through 34. While the Deuteronomic character of the teaching is exhibited in Matthew 7, which ends the second division of the book of Matthew. The king has been introduced and his kingdom announced. We are now to witness his work of faith and his labor of love. Division 3, the ministry of the king. Matthew chapters 8 through 12. When he was come down from the mountain, great multitudes followed him. And behold, there came a leper and worshipped him, saying, Lord, if thou wilt, thou canst make me clean. And Jesus put forth his hand and touched him, saying, I will, be thou clean. And immediately his leprosy was cleansed. And Jesus saith unto him, See thou tell no man, but go thy way, show thyself to the priest, and offer the gift that Moses commanded for a testimony unto them. Matthew chapter 8, verses 1 through 4. The ministry of Christ as the king commences with his coming down from his seat upon the mountain, a hint of the humbling of himself in his descent from heaven to serve the sinful and the diseased. We have here also another dispensational lesson with which these gospel records abound. The healing of the leper by the touch of the king, who then sends him to witness to the priest of the cleansing, is figurative of Christ's testimony to the nation of Israel, whom he must first serve. Afterwards, he heals the centurion's servant by his word, not his touch, figuring the present Gentile age when the king is absent. Later, he enters Peter's house and finds his mother-in-law sick. He delivers her by a touch. She arises immediately, perfectly well. The touch assures us that he is again present, as when he returns to the nation of Israel, whom he dearly loves. While the healing of the sick of all kinds, with the reference to the mighty prophecy from Isaiah, tells us of that great day of deliverance which is yet to come to this ruined, devastated earth and its inhabitants, because of the obedience unto death of the perfect servant of Jehovah. The cure of leprosy was unknown in Israel, even as is the case today. But Israel was taught that God alone could and did deliver from this condition. Leviticus 14. Because of its incurable nature, it is the fitting type of the ineradicable evil of sin. And it was fitting that the king should commence his ministry to men with the healing of the leper. It loudly witnesses that he refuses to take the kingdom except as the Son of God, and this was the character in which he was first rejected by the leaders of the people. As was said earlier, leprosy is incurable, and as such it is a striking type of sin. It has five points of resemblance. 1. Its subtle invasion. 2. Its certain spread. 3. Its contagious character. 4. Its sundering of human relationships. And 5. Its exile from the congregation of the Lord. Man was powerless in the presence of this malignant scourge, and the mere touch of a leper brought defilement in Israel. The law in Israel was very stringent regarding the dreaded malady. It showed no mercy whatever to the victims of its ravages. It held out no hope of their recovery except in the mercy of God. They were banished from the house of God and from the congregation of the upright, and condemned to isolation from family and friends. They were shut up to certain death unless God intervened. Hence, they knew of their condition, and they had to make themselves known as a leper by calling unclean, unclean, at the approach of anyone, so that none might come in contact with them. This was the effect of the law upon a leper in Israel. Leviticus 13. Do you not see the marvelous correspondence? Herein we are given a striking picture of the results of the law upon the sinner. It manifests his condition, shows him up, points him out not only to himself but to others. The law makes the offense to abound, and by the law is the knowledge of sin. Romans 3:20 and 5:20. But it offers no help for the sinner's woeful condition, nor any solution for his problem. It condemns him to banishment from the house and family of God. He is helpless and hopeless unless God have mercy. The law has no mercy. It shuts man up to certain and eternal death. The wages of sin is death. Romans 6:23. Therefore, there could not be found a more suitable case for the beginning of Christ's ministry as king than the unclean leper who had come and worshipped him, saying, "Lord, if thou wilt, thou canst make me clean." He acknowledged Christ's power to heal, but doubted his willingness and his mercy. How perfect a picture of the legal heart of Israel! But the Lord would have none question his mercy. It is as great as his power. He does not merely speak, but goes further. He touches the leper, the only man who dared or could break through the barrier of the law and remove every taint of that which the law could brand, but could not remedy. "I will, be thou clean," we hear him say, and lo, the leprosy departs instantly. The man is clean. But now Jesus sends him to the priest, the representative of the law, that he may also pronounce him clean. For only so could he be admitted back into the congregation of the Lord. The law had condemned and shut him out, therefore it must be satisfied and silenced by the one greater than Moses, who is about to take the leper's place. Christ healed him in view of the cross upon which he was to hang. The leper is counted dead. He died, as it were, in his substitute, and the new man who has arisen in his stead, the law pronounces clean. There is no spot in him. Then comes the healing of the centurion's servant, the Gentile, whose faith the king commended as being greater than that of Israel. Matthew 7, verses 5 through 13. He is a most vivid contrast to the leper who doubted Christ's mercy. The centurion, on the contrary, magnified it. He doubted neither the king's power nor his willingness to heal. He had such confidence in his word and such a sense of his own unworthiness that he will not even request him to come into his house. "Speak the word only, and my servant shall be healed," he cries. Matthew 7:8. True humility believes God. So often when God's free, unconditional promises are proclaimed, we hear someone say, "Oh, that is too much to believe. I cannot take that. It is too much to say that I am as Christ. I am not worthy," etc. And generally such saints think that they are very humble in talking in this manner, while the fact is just the opposite. This is simply the unbelief of the old man who refuses the grace of God. He argues because of his own legal heart that it is too much to expect that God should freely give to us all things, that he should bless us with every spiritual blessing in the heavenly places in Christ, irrespective of our worth. But it is in Christ's worth that we are accepted, and it is humility on our part gladly to take God at his word and get the benefit of his mercy, even as this dear centurion. While he acknowledged that it is grace on Christ's part, and that he is unworthy of the smallest favor, yet faith so moves him that he promptly takes all that Christ wants to give. He sees him as the King, the one in authority whom all things serve. Let him speak the word only, and everything must do his bidding. The centurion is also under authority. That is, he affirms that he knows what it is to obey orders, and he also knows what it is to give orders, to exact obedience from others. Therefore, he assures the Lord that he believes that it is only necessary for him to speak the word of command, and disease and pain must depart. He will not even ask him to come into his house. The king's word is sufficient. No marvel that the Lord eulogizes such faith, the faith of the Gentile who did not have the light or the religious privileges of the chosen nation, Israel. It must have refreshed the heart of the Lord in contrast with the doubting, formal religious Pharisee. In the centurion, he saw an earnest of the gathered multitudes of every nation, tongue, and kindred, whom he has delivered by his word from sin and its results during this age. These, he says, who shall come from opposite quarters of the earth, shall sit down with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven, while the sons of the kingdom, the claimants of that which they were now rejecting, would be cast into outer darkness, for God, the light, would be withdrawn from them. Then they, Israel, would weep and wail in unavailing regret and anguish. Matthew 8, verses 11 through 12. The third healing in this account has also its figurative significance. The Lord heals again by touch, as in the case of the leper. He enters the house of Peter's wife's mother, who was lying sick of a fever, and delivers, not by his word, but by his presence. Natural relationships are again owned, is the lesson here. The Lord will again take his place in the house of Israel when the fullness of the Gentiles has come in. He will return to the sphere of his old relationship and bring healing to the nation of Israel, who is still beloved for the Father's sake, even as Peter's mother-in-law was healed for the Apostle Peter's sake. The fever of restless longing, of covetousness and passion in Israel will be stilled by his presence. He will touch their hand, and the fever will leave them, and they will arise in the power of a new life, to a new devotedness, and minister unto him. This meaning is further emphasized by that which follows. When the even was come, they brought unto him many that were possessed with devils, and he cast out the spirits with his word, and healed all that were sick, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by Isaiah the prophet, saying, himself took our infirmities and bare our sicknesses. Matthew 8, verses 16 through 17. When the evening was come, is the end of the age typified. They brought to him many that were possessed with devils, showing that Israel's restoration will certainly be the beginning of a great day for man. Satan will be cast out, his tyranny over man will cease, man's shackles will be loosed, the captives set free when the deliverer comes out of Zion. All this will come to pass because the saying of Isaiah will have been fulfilled. Himself took our infirmities and bare our sicknesses. Here is positive proof that healing is included in the atonement. For Isaiah 53, whence this is quoted, is the atonement chapter. The cross, which marks Christ as the Son of Man, will be the basis of all the blessing to the earth and remove the results of sin of whatever character. The blessing will not be limited to Israel, though the widest outflow and fullest deliverance from the curse will come upon the land of Palestine. It is there that the wilderness will blossom as the rose. Isaiah 35, 1, American Standard Version. In the above three healings, we have the king sketched for us in his predicted place, first as Son of God in the healing of the leper, then as Son of Abraham in the deliverance of the Gentile centurion's servant, and lastly as Son of David Israel's Messiah in the lifting up and restoration to service of Peter's wife's mother. These three characters, in each of which he shows himself master, are his title to all that follows. Hence, we are not surprised to find that all things are in his hands. Circumstances bow to him, men as well as elements obey his voice. The power of Satan is prostrate in his presence. Sins are forgiven, and the lame rise up and walk. Such are the convincing evidences that this is indeed the promised Redeemer of men. His sovereignty demonstrated. We have noted the basis of the sovereignty of Christ in the preceding part of his ministry. We are now to view the sovereignty itself. The first exhibition is given us in his dealings with men. Notice in this connection that he calls for no volunteers. He chooses the men of his cabinet. And a certain scribe came and said unto him, Master, I will follow thee whithersoever thou goest. And Jesus saith unto him, The foxes have holes, and the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man hath not where to lay his head. Matthew 8, verses 19 and 20. The first one who offers to follow him is rebuffed with these words, Foxes have holes, the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man hath not where to lay his head. He tells the man that he has nothing to offer him, no wealth nor honors of earth. His cause is a losing one as far as earthly advantages are concerned, though he has heavenly honors and rewards to distribute. But he is assured that the man is not seeking these, for they are spiritually discerned and are given to men of the king's own choice, even as is the prerogative of earthly potentates. They are sovereign in this respect. They choose their men. Then we are shown that he is master in the life of those whom he calls. One of these disciples intimates that he must go and bury his father, a most necessary and filial act, as man would judge. But instead, the master of his men says, Follow me and let the dead bury their dead. Matthew 8:22. He will not allow the nearest fleshly claim to interfere or take precedence of his claim. Cruel, you say? No, he is Lord in the fullest sense over all those whom he chooses. He insists upon prompt and unhesitating obedience. Furthermore, his disciples are messengers of life and not of death. They are sent, as Paul expressed it, not to baptize the old man, but to preach the good news concerning a new man. Now we are to view creation itself subject to its creator and master. As the multitudes gather about him, the commander issues orders to depart unto the other side, and when he entered into a ship, his disciples followed him. Matthew 8, verse 18 and 23. Note the language. It is plainly evident, and shortly it is manifested, that he is the master and able to bear all the responsibility as leader and captain. Mark tells us that they took him as he was in the ship, intimating that he was weary, even unto exhaustion with the toil of the way. But Matthew gives us not even a hint of this, except that we might infer it in the fact that he went away from the multitude. For he is sketching the sovereign, while Mark's picture is of the servant, and each is consistent and perfect in every detail. Even though he is the creator, yet he is most marvelously disguised in a body of limitations and creature frailty. We here view him in meekest surrender to circumstances, in a place of absolute weakness, yet maintaining his title as sovereign, calm and unruffled in the midst of imminent danger. He is sleeping in perfect peace on a stormy sea until awakened by his terrified disciples crying, Lord, save us, we perish. Matthew 8:25. He is amazed at their unbelief. Why are ye fearful, O ye of little faith? He cries. Then he arose and rebuked the wind and the sea as though these elements were intelligent beings, because he is really rebuking and commanding Satan. He was the power that roused and stirred the elements, intending to drown the Lord of life. But instead they are conquered by a greater power. There was a great calm, Matthew 8:26. Again, we emphasize the fact that the master of sea and land was on that ship, and when he speaks, all things obey. We do not marvel that the men marveled and exclaimed in deepest awe, "What manner of man is this that even the winds and the sea obey him?" Matthew 8:27. Oh yes, there is another manner of man upon the scene, one to whom all other men must yield the scepter and acknowledge him Lord and King. The restless Sea of Galilee, which means wheel, is a vivid representation of the world through which we are passing, while our little bark is often tossed about and lashed with turbulent winds and waves. But the Master travels with us and speaks again and again his word of command when we are not able to bear any more because of our little faith. When the storms come, how often it appears as though he was asleep, but this is only for the exercise of faith, not for its defeat. Often we too awaken him with our cry or prayer of unbelief, though no waves can sink the vessel on which the Master sails. As he teaches here, if we could rest amidst the tempest as he did, we would see far more of the works of the Lord and his wonders in the deep. Psalm 107:24. Now they come to the other side, to the country of the Gergesenes, meaning reward at the end. And when he was come to the other side into the country of the Gergesenes, there met him two possessed with devils coming out of the tombs, exceeding fierce, so that no man might pass by that way. Matthew 8:28. No doubt these were Israelites of the tribe of Gad, which means a troop, and speaks of the increase of faith which is needed now, for the enemy's power was rampant here. Their way is blocked by two demon-filled men. We would call them maniacs. Mark and Luke give us more details regarding these, but Matthew is consistent, as heretofore, in emphasizing Christ's sovereignty in these various cases. Therefore, he does not stress the details. He tells us that they abode in tombs, in the ghastly horror of death, and their insane fury, before which men quailed, only makes more vivid the contrast of their surrender to the Master. The demons acknowledge his authority, if men do dispute it, and give him his title, Son of God, which men deny, and recognize him as their future judge. They are aware that there is a day of judgment and a place of torment into which they expect to be cast, but they plead that this time has not yet come. What marvelous intelligence of him and the purposes of God concerning them! The account of the swine which follows is certainly a positive witness, as the number two would indicate, of the reality of demon possession. The demons give utterance to the men, recognize the Lord with intelligence as to his deity. They address him and are addressed by him, the men being only the houses in which they dwelt. They are master in their habitations. What a picture of the unregenerate man whom Satan rules and to whom he is only a slave. The demons request that if he cast them out, they acknowledge his sovereignty, he would allow them to enter into a herd of swine which are feeding nearby. He gives the desired permission, and thereupon the whole herd of swine, 2,000 strong, ran violently down a steep place into the sea and perished in the waters. Matthew 8:32. We learn here the cause of mad dogs and their accompanying dread of water, the sign of the abyss into which all demons, the legion, will one day be cast by this very same man. We have no after picture here of the men, clothed and in their right mind, as is shown in Luke 8:26, for Matthew would concentrate our attention upon the deliverance itself, which shows Christ's sovereignty over all the power of Satan and his kingdom of darkness and death. His mighty manifestation here meets with no hearty acclamations of delight, rather otherwise, for people were then, as now, more occupied with the loss of their swine than with the glory of the King. The shadow of his rejection begins to fall upon him. The whole city, which has heard the news, comes out to meet him and requests the great deliverer to depart out of their coasts. Matthew 7, verses 33 through 34. They are far more afraid of him who comes with life and light than of the awful power of Satan from which he would have set them free if they had so desired. The Lord accepts their rejection of him and leaves them alone. They do not need to ask him the second time. He passes over and comes into his own city, a conqueror indeed. All the clashing elements have yielded to his influence. The power of the enemy has been routed. The strong man's captives are set free. Now we are to view the very innermost stronghold of the adversary entered, and man's condition bared, his need met, his burden of guilt lifted, and the paralysis, which is the outward result of sin, removed. For we must constantly bear in mind that all the visible material realities of these inspired narratives are but shadows of spiritual realities. Therefore, the miracles are not only wonders, but they are signs of the unseen and eternal. And behold, they brought to him a man sick of the palsy, lying on a bed. And Jesus, seeing their faith, said unto the sick of the palsy, Son, be of good cheer, thy sins be forgiven thee. Matthew 9, verse 2. The great physician of humanity, seeing the faith of those who carried the man, diagnosed the case immediately, saying to the man, Son, be of good cheer, thy sins be forgiven thee. Ah, this was like waving a red flag in front of these wild bulls of Bashan. Psalm 22:12. Certain of them bellowed forth their rage, saying, This man blasphemeth. Matthew 9:3. The master is calm, unruffled, serene. He, knowing their thoughts, for they had not told all, said, Why do you think evil in your hearts? For whether is it easier to say, Thy sins be forgiven thee, note the order of blessing here, or to say, Arise and walk, Matthew 9, 5. Has asked a hard question indeed, but he answers it himself. For, says he, the healing of this man is proof to you that the Son of Man has power on earth to forgive sins, Matthew 9, 6. He is endeavoring to teach them the helplessness of the old creation, that the man's outward visible condition was only a sign of the palsied inward state, and that the latter was the cause of the former. He not only wanted to cure the disease, but remove the cause. Therefore, the man not only arose, but walked off carrying his bed, for with pardon assured him, the load of his sins was lifted, and this gave power to his paralyzed limbs to walk in the way of obedience to God. But the opposers refuse to be convinced. They do not want the man Jesus to reign over them. If they admit that he has authority to forgive sins, they are admitting that he is the Son of God and the Messiah of Israel. And this they will not do, even though they are forced to acknowledge that he can and does heal the sick. Yet how strange that the opposite conditions prevail today. Professing Christians all admit that Christ has authority to forgive sins, but doubt his power or at least his willingness to heal the body. The one is, as Jesus says, the outward visible sign of the other. The master is, as we have seen, entering the strong man's house and despoiling him of his goods, showing his power to annul him who hath the power of death, even the devil. Calling of the 12. And as Jesus passed forth from thence, he saw a man named Matthew sitting at the receipt of custom. And he saith unto him, Follow me. And he arose and followed him. Matthew 9, verse 9. In the case of each of the men whom the master calls, we have some significant instruction. There was nothing haphazard nor indefinite in any of the Lord's words nor actions. They are all pregnant with meaning to the spiritual saint. In Matthew 4, we saw that he called Peter and Andrew, brothers, from their lowly work as fishermen. They were casting a net into the sea when they heard his voice, And they straightway left their nets, their old occupation, to engage in his service and become fishers of men. Matthew 4, verses 18 and 19. Shortly after this episode, he speaks his word of command to James and John, sons of Zebedee. 2, the number of witnesses is emphasized in both cases. These men were engaged in the irksome task of mending their old worn-out nets when they were called to the gladsome service of launching a new net, for the kingdom upon the basis of law had woefully failed. The law was weak through the flesh. It could not hold the fish in its meshes after they were caught. They would break through its every restraint and escape. Therefore, the scribes and Pharisees, by their additions of the law, set men to mending the net. They endeavored to make it firmer and stronger by their self-efforts, hoping thereby, as they foolishly imagined, to remedy its weakness, for they thought the trouble was with the law instead of with the flesh.